Welcome to the Science Podcast. It's February 16th, 2013. I'm Sarah Crespi, and this is a special podcast from the AAAS meeting in Boston. Is violent crime more like polio or a car accident? Do we need a vaccine or many small adjustments like better roads, driver education, and seatbelt laws? Economist Jens Ludwig makes the case there is no one solution and that small, light interventions can prevent violent crime and provide large returns on investment. I spoke with him about his work getting solid numbers to support these ideas.
Okay, I'm Jens Ludwig. I'm a public policy professor at the University of Chicago, and I'm the director of the University of Chicago Crime Lab.
Okay, so what was your talk about today?
We had a panel on benefit-cost analysis for crime reduction, and I talked about the great value of small effects. Crime is a huge problem, especially violent crime. People are looking for a miracle cure, like the sock vaccine for violence. I argued that that search for a sock vaccine for violence causes us to overlook small, useful interventions that can help. And I gave an example of a very light touch stop, look, and listen intervention that we did in juvenile detention in partnership with the staff there that reduces recidivism rates by 5% among very high-risk juvenile offenders, which doesn't sound like a big deal until you realize that it's a very cheap intervention, that the cost of crime are enormous and the benefit-cost ratios, so the ratio of social benefits to the cost of the intervention, are just off the charts.
Okay, well, let's talk about some of the costs of crime. Give us some impressive statistics about how costly crime is worldwide and in the U.S.
So there are about 500,000 people murdered worldwide every year. That's about the population of the city of Atlanta, murdered each and every year. As Peter Reuter, one of the other panel members, said, the social cost of crime in the United States is measured in units that start with a T, trillion. So I think there's some debate about whether it's 1 or 2 trillion a year, but that's sort of the order of magnitude that we're talking about. And Phil Cook and I have estimated that the cost to society from every gunshot wound, so every assault-related gunshot wound, is about $1 million. Every homicide, Mark Cohen has estimated, costs society about $10 million. You really do not need to make a very big dent in this problem in order to generate huge benefits to society.
Well, can you talk a little bit in detail about the kind of interventions you're talking about, these small changes that can make that could be cost-effective and also make a change across a swath of population?
Sure. So when we do what we call social autopsies of youth violence events in Chicago, you see that a lot of this is automatic or impulsive behavior. So it's small provocations that escalate and turn into tragedies, often because someone has a gun. One way that you can make a dent in the problem is to try and reduce the chances that a kid has got a gun on the street when a fight happens. That's what the Obama administration is really, I think, appropriately focused on trying to solve right now. The other thing that you can do is try and solve the violence part of the gun violence equation, and that is to reduce the chances that people behave automatically or impulsively when a provocation occurs. And so we've been doing these interventions that are based on cognitive behavioral therapy and psychology in different settings in Chicago.
What's cognitive behavioral therapy?
So cognitive behavioral therapy is based on the idea that a lot of unhelpful behaviors stem from people behaving a little bit too automatically to their social environment and behaving specifically automatically based on some misperception about the way the world works. And so one example of this is what psychologists call hostile attribution bias. You grow up in an environment where it's very economically disadvantaged and dangerous. Your mom is very stressed. She yells at you and your siblings a lot. It makes it very hard for you to learn how to accurately infer the social intentions of other people. So now someone from that sort of background goes out into the world and gets yelled at by their teacher. Someone says something to them that you or I might interpret one way. If the default is to interpret it in a hostile way, that can lead to a fight and an escalation. And what these interventions try and do is get people to recognize the circumstances in which automatic behavior can lead to trouble and help them recognize some unhelpful biased beliefs that they need to be aware of and change.
So you talked about using this type of intervention in Chicago. Can you give us some quick overview of your results? What kind of numbers are you seeing?
We've done a couple of these experiments in Chicago. We did a randomized experiment in partnership with two local nonprofits, Youth Guidance and World Sport Chicago, and the Chicago Public Schools, and found that working with 7th to 10th grade boys in some very tough South and West Side neighborhoods, So just over 1 year, the average program participant attended about 13 program sessions, and that reduced their violent crime arrest rate by about 44%. So that was a really big effect among a set of kids who were on the path to engaging in really serious violence, but we could interrupt that process with this pretty light touch intervention that in that case led to very big effects. A different sort of example of an intervention that we've done in Chicago is in the Juvenile Temporary Detention Center, which is kids who have already engaged in extremely dangerous behavior. So this is the highest risk juvenile offenders in Chicago. And we find for them that this kind of light touch, stop, look, and listen cognitive behavioral therapy intervention reduces return rates by about 5%. Which doesn't sound like a big deal until you recognize that the cost of the intervention is very low. You have the staff, you have the kids, you have the facility. The marginal cost of doing the intervention is basically just mostly just training up the staff to do this. And the 5% reduction in recidivism rates is a big deal because the antisocial, that is criminal and violent behavior that these kids otherwise would have engaged in, is enormously costly to society. And so that small dent in the problem in the juvenile detention center application generates benefits that are multiple times the costs.
Well, so these are kind of bespoke interventions, things that are very tailored to the situation that you're looking at. Is there a way of scaling them up?
So our goal at the University of Chicago Crime Lab is to try and think about how to help address the crime violence problem at scale. One of the things that's been very interesting to us about doing these different experiments with CBT or Stop, Look, and Listen in different applications is that we found that, you know, we looked at one of these interventions in the Chicago public schools with boys who are on the path to engaging in serious violence but haven't quite reached there yet. Intervention is done in one particular way by these local nonprofits. You see effects. It's done in juvenile detention by the staff. Very different design of the intervention, and yet you also see effects. And that makes us think that there is some sort of shared underlying active ingredient that is there that we don't yet completely understand. So I'm working on a project with Arnold Foundation funding with Sendhil Mullainathan at Harvard Economics and Anuj Shah, who's a psychologist at the Booth School of Business at the University of Chicago. And we're trying to unpack what the mechanisms are, what the most important active ingredients are behind these very different looking interventions as a way to develop something that can be taken to scale, because we would be able to know what the most important active ingredient is that we need to make sure is there and being delivered effectively as we ramp this up and do it for lots more kids.
So a couple of the questions in the audience talked more broadly about policy and politics. You talked about how your goal is to actually help out the city of Chicago. Can you talk a little bit about how that works?
Yeah, sure. So I moved to Chicago in 2007, and the Chicago Tribune was running headlines almost every day about counting the number of Chicago public school kids who'd been shot that year. When I got there in 2007, youth violence was already very high on the priority list for local policymakers. The city at that point got a bunch of money from the federal government from the Stimulus Act, including money earmarked for addressing youth violence. We met with the city, said we are eager to put this into something that is helpful. What should we do? And there really is just shockingly little good evidence right now about what to do. And so it wasn't that the public had any particular technocratic view about which specific intervention should be done. The public is just looking at the Chicago Tribune headlines saying, someone needs to help reduce the number of Chicago public school kids being shot. Just do it. And so what we've been trying to do is work with local and state government in Chicago, but not just in Chicago, to do randomized control trials of the sort that provide gold standard evidence in medicine but are still way too rare in the social policy area, to learn more about what really works, why, and for who, so that we can provide this sort of technocratic guidance to policymakers when they're trying to decide how to allocate scarce intervention resources across different potential uses. They can actually put their money in interventions that have the highest return on investment. And I've been really surprised and pleased at the receptivity of the policymaking community to that sort of evidence and guidance.
Great. Well, thank you so much for talking with me.
Sure. Thanks very much.
That was Jens Ludwig talking about quantifying the value of low-cost crime fighting. Thanks for listening to The Science Podcast. I'm Sarah Crespi. Check back on iTunes, the RSS feed, or the Science site for more podcasts from the meeting.